All right. Hello, everybody. Welcome to Boomer Optimism. I think, James, this is the first time you and I have been on here together. Weirdly, I think you've only talked to other people, which is so
Is that
weird because you and I talk.
possible? Yeah.
You're my only DO friend, I think, who I have like more offline conversations with than like recorded conversations. But James Pogue is here. Chris Mott is here. Both previous guests. I want to have you both just kind of briefly introduce yourselves, and then I'll kind of talk about the idea for the episode and start off with some questions. Let's start with Chris.
Sure. Yeah, I'm Christopher Mott. I'm a Washington Fellow with the Institute for Peace and Diplomacy, formerly a State Department researcher, and also formerly worked at Defense Priorities and also academia way back in the day. Now I just mostly focus on in the realism and restraint community and foreign policy, and just trying to have a sane, rational, less interventionist foreign policy all around, and kind of focusing on relocalization and re-regionalization of foreign policy in a world where globalization's kind of failed.
Perfect. James.
I am James Pogue. I've been on this a lot. I write for a lot, I think, for Harper's, for Vanity Fair, for increasingly for the New York Times, which is different and new. And my thing is sort of explaining the wild and weird world that perhaps Ashley and I live in, world of thought and that sort of thing, to the normies. That's kind of how I make money. But I also, as longtime listeners of this podcast will know, am really into forestry policy and California native plants, extremely into fish and watershed restoration and stuff like that. And bouncing off what Christopher was saying, my kind of big project is figuring out what, kind of at a high level in quotation marks, but trying to imagine what a statecraft and vision of American policy would look like if you were trying to take into account the things that people who listen to DO maybe care about. So that is what I've tried to do and continue to try to do, and maybe we will talk about.
So that's perfect. And so basically my idea here is I was talking with Chris about this before we started, but basically there are so few people in the whole world who report on and think about and write about international politics, geopolitics in a way that's not team sports, first of all, and second of all, in a way that actually considers collapse-ish, American decline things. And so I consider you two some of the only people who like are in that intersection. And so James has just gotten back from a long period of reporting in Africa and writing in Europe and France, I believe. And I just kind of wanted to pick his brain about that experience, some of the insights he got from that experience. Maybe we would probably have to go over some of the stuff you did on Good Old Boys, James, again, just to kind of get background to make not make people go listen to that one, just to follow on this one. But and then I wanted to get Chris's take on some of this stuff because I'm obviously not a foreign policy person, but Chris is, he thinks a lot about these things in the same ways that we do. So that's why this episode is happening. I kind of want to start with, well, maybe you should start, James, with some of your story. I don't know if you want to start as far back as your original trip to Africa, or if you want to start with your experience in the Central African Republic or what, but you decide where you want to start to kind of like tell us the story of what you were experiencing.
Yeah, let me see if I can do this concisely because I think, not to anticipate what Chris is going to say, but I think maybe it kind of sets us up for somewhere to take this conversation. Me not being by trade a foreign policy expert, but having sort of personal experience of the edges of empire, and maybe how that empire is not working like it once did. Again, people who've listened to this podcast a long time probably know, but like I dropped out of college and rode freight trains for a long time around the country. And then at 21, I sort of ended up through a friend getting a job as a cook on a crew of guys, pilots and geophysicists and and mechanics who were looking for what turned out to be gold in the Saharan Desert of the country of Mauritania, which is sort of like south of Morocco, touches Algeria, Mali. It's north of Senegal. It's on the northwest coast of Africa. But it's primarily desert, and it's 3 million people. At the time, it was 3 million people. In a country the size of Texas, it's extremely low density. It's a place where up until the 1970s, 1980s, was almost 80%, if not higher, nomadic herders, people who literally, truly, in the late 20th century lived off the land. And it was to some degree because of that, untouched by some of the French colonial projects, the mission civilisatrice, as people say, the civilizing mission. It was kind of, you can't really do a civilizing mission to people who can just like go live, in the high desert and like not pay attention to you. And so, like already there, I was really entranced by this because I was in a town called Zourat, which is in the far northeast of Mauritania, sort of like almost near the Algerian border. And there's no road to get there. So I was like 21 years old, white male. You have to take a Hilux 24 hours across the desert or take a, single engine plane. I was like, this is awesome. And it was a frontier town. This is where I'm getting to. It was a truly a frontier town. It's a place that's only connected to civilization via, at the time, a single rail line that goes and extracts resources from the periphery and brings them back to the core, like the literal definition of an empire's relationship to its periphery, right? And my job was, I was helping a crew. I was doing the logistics for a crew of people looking to make geophysical maps, which is the first step in any mining exploration. So you make the geophysical maps, so measure magnetism or radioactivity or density or something like that, and you look and basically make like a kind of topographical map of sensor readings that show what are called anomalies. And anomalies, that's where you would go and drill and say, oh, that's a promising spot, right? So like old geophysics guys be like, that's a real good anomaly, man. You see it on the map. And so I did that for about a year, and loved it, candidly, and like had a kind of very conflicted experience because I was like a nerd, I guess, and like I was really into foreign policy and thinking about this stuff. And I was very aware, like, oh, I am doing the work of empire. This is how you bring people into the American system, right? And I'm at the literal fringes, one of the last places on earth where there are nomads and people who live outside of the cultural, financial, and military systems that define this empire, right? And I was not super happy about pushing those frontiers farther, right? And catching more people inside the system. But also because I was weirdly elected the chief of the crew, it was me who handed the $7.5 million DVD of data to the mining engineer at Rio Tinto, like one of the world's big evil mining firms. Like that was, I was the one signing those papers. I was the one doing all that stuff. So it was very implicated stuff. Fast forward, become a journalist, all this stuff, and I guess like some of my fears, and this is I think what we'll talk about maybe, some of my fears in coming back 15 years later to do reporting about resource extraction and things like that in Africa today have been allayed sort of by a worst case scenario, maybe, of the American empire faltering, but not really anyone having like a good replacement for it. And so like what floods into the gap is chaos. And so I went to the Central African Republic, intending to report on how artisanal, as they call it, artisanal gold mining works, and just was basically immediately arrested by government figures aligned with the Russian Wagner Group, and was expelled from the country. We can talk in more detail about this. This is a little bit what I went into on the Good Old Boys podcast. From there, though, I went back to the Sahel region, and to the Sahara and to Mauritania. And what's interesting there is that that region, since the time I was there, has really erupted in a pretty significant transnational war led by jihadists who attacked my hotel, for example, when I was in Mauritania at first. They have kind of moved from Mauritania, and they have enlisted through various means as foot soldiers, people from the Peul-speaking kind of group of ethnic, traditionally herders and nomads. And what I'm working on now, and what I think is really interesting, is that if you actually look at a map of conflict in Africa, north of the equator, almost every war has some component, usually of Peul-speaking people, but also just in general of nomadic herding peoples. Because it turns out that you can't just like draw a bunch of nation states and get rid of these traditional ways of life. You got to either kill everybody or figure out a way to incorporate people. And that did not happen. And now there's this sort of like weird resurgence of nomadism and traditional modes of smuggling and trafficking that have financed a lot of this stuff. And above all, and then I'll stop, and above all, this weird thing where despite the fact that a lot of the kind of disconnection from the global system that nomadism allowed has disappeared because of the drought that is expanding across the Sahel and the Sahara, the gold that we were looking for when I was in Mauritania has been discovered in great quantities. And so now you can go and mine gold as a guy with no access to outside capital, and you can make a lot of money, and you can sell that to drug traffickers and jihadists and criminals and rich guys in Dubai, and you can build an entire network of resource extraction that gets you outside of the Western system. And it's financing a lot of war and chaos. And it's bringing Russia in. And I regard it to some degree as a sort of tradition that has existed in this region for a long time. So that's kind of what I'm working on.
Chris, I'm going to let you dig into whatever part interests you
Yeah, I'm actually
first.
really happy to hear about this particular focus of yours because before I was an international relations person, I was a history person, and my focus was on nomadic people, particularly nomadic
Oh.
people state building. The book I published, which was originally inspired by my dissertation, The Formless Empire, is about how Turco-Mongolian people like made empires and made states, and how this actually
Wow.
influenced Eurasian history up until the present day in some ways. So I'm always interested in nomadic people and how they navigate geopolitics specifically. So it sounds like what you're talking about is very much, I mean, you summed up most of the things I would ask, how they were the ones who were able to avoid kind of the cultural conversion of Victorian France, how they were the ones who set themselves more apart and now have a bit more autonomy. What I'm curious on building off of is how this kind of intersects with recent, and I know we just said we didn't want to just talk about like the team thing, but in this particular region, I think it has to come up, how this is kind of impacted specifically by the power of the jihadists, because jihadists were not one of the most major players in this region until, of course, the United States and NATO toppled the Libyan government and created this kind of huge backwash of state failure and militarized non-state actors that then flooded south across the Sahara and plagued Burkina Faso, plagued Mali, and led, of course, to American military expansion in the Sahel to counteract this thing that they had kind of created. So I'm kind of curious as to like what the intersection with the post-war shocks of the Libya war and how many of these networks could, are connected to jihadists versus how many are not, perhaps.
So I would push back on that a little, just because, and honestly, I didn't, this is weird. I didn't know about this history until I went back to the region, which is kind of surprising to me because it's kind of fundamental to it. But if you look at the kind of the close to but pre-colonial history of the Sahel, it's the entire history of that region at that time was actually conflicts between Peul jihadists, who found the most famous is Dan Fodio, who founded the Caliphate of, what was it? Do you know the name of it? But who founded, who waged wars against the sedentary Hausa kings in what is now northern Nigeria, and founded a caliphate in I think 1805 that lasted 100 years. And these happened a lot. There were like three or
Well, these
four total.
I would not call these jihadists. The fact that an empire has an Islamic element to it would not count as like a modern day terrorist
Dan
organization.
Fodio used the word jihad himself. He used the word
Yes,
jihad
they all
himself.
did. So the Arab caliphates, that to me is not a modern day equivalent to like the jihadist networks that are non-state
Well,
actors that we have today.
I guess we're already in the weeds here, but I guess what I'm saying is, so for people who don't know, so The pull being a sort of lighter skin traditionally, turban wearing, herding people, who might, who have these conflicts that go back literally to the beginning of essentially history with people who are settled, sedentary, and represent centralized authority. This is the classic problem of settled human history, right? Is how do you
Yes.
get rid of the, how do you deal with the guys who are outside on the periphery, right? And like, yeah, I mean, I'm using the word jihad in, I guess, in a sense that can be interpreted in a lot of different ways. I'm using it because they used it, and because I'm trying to drive home the fact that in these kind of major regional wars that were kicked off by Poe moving around, the use of Islam and the use of quote unquote jihad was a way of saying, you guys do not live according to this way that we do. We live right, and we are prosecuting this war against you, both because you are kind of an infidel and because we kind of have structural political hurting problems with you. And these things have been forever linked, right? So
Yes.
that's all I'm kind of saying.
That's helpful, yeah.
Well, no, that's absolutely correct. Yes, that's true. There is a difference between modern jihadist groups and this old history of like Berber tribes and Tuareg tribes, using this kind of the decadent civilizations that they're going against. I
For sure.
personally draw a distinction because of how it functions, but I see your point.
Yeah, that, and I yeah, I think we're and so like in answer to the post-Qaddafi stuff. So to kind of give a more recent coloring of the regional history, France comes in the Western Sahel, and the Sahel is a sort of Arabic word, means coast or shoreline, something like that. And so you can kind of imagine it's like a grassy savanna, short thorny tree, a vast space of this that stretches entirely across the African continent, but that separates equatorial, more foresty, rainy Africa from the oceanic vastness of the Sahara, right? So you have this band that is very wide and maybe shrinking because the Sahara is growing, but has often, in the same way that the American West is good for grazing and not great for farming, the Sahel has somewhat similar arid natural
Geography.
history.
Got it.
And so France comes in and runs these countries. These are for the in the western end of the Sahel, it's all French colonies. And after France leaves, they institute this thing that is known as the Françafrique, which is a kind of like very sophisticated, honestly, system of post-colonial control that gave France like much more direct control over its former colonies than most of the other European colonial powers retained, because France is really obsessed with itself in certain ways, and especially at that time was really obsessed with making sure that it retained. Charles de Gaulle spoke often of France's glory, right? And he, like all of these Gaullist guys who ruled France up and almost until the end stage neoliberal of Macron comes along, like you have this Gaullist tradition where the French glory is a big thing, right? And so the American Empire kind of delegates France to be what they called the gendarme of Africa and what the Soviets called the Cubans of Africa. They're kind of like these dudes who they're the sub-empire, they're in charge of that shit. Do
Yeah.
that. We don't want to have to worry about it. Gaddafi during this time is this weird, like wily bête noir of the French. And he's always trying to do this weird Pan-African stuff. And Chris, you know more about this history than I do. But what I will say is that when I was in Mauritania in 2007, you are correct that there was a lid on a lot of this stuff because at the time, the quote unquote jihad was largely Arabs who were highly sophisticated veterans of the Algerian Civil War, who were members of this group called the GSPC, which is whatever, we don't have to go into the acronym, but which is an offshoot of the Islamists who won a free and fair election in Algeria in 1993. And should by rights, democratic rights have taken power, but were considered too scary and Islamist to be allowed to take power. And so thus we have a brutal long-running civil war that ends up destabilizing all of France's empire and causing it to lose all its former colonies.
Right.
All of this stuff has long histories that are really hard to trace, but all of these actions end up being very stupid. So one of the stupid actions that France and the US took was not allowing that government to take power. This causes the GSPC. The GSPC turns into this kind of like weird, much like the Irish Republican Army later would, this weird kind of thing of warlords and cigarette smugglers and gun traffickers and stuff. And they make a ton of money. These are traditional trade routes that take a lot of money. They're buying off politicians in northern Mali and Mauritania. They control things. These dudes are transnational warlords. They're not just cigarette smugglers. And we often talk about them that way. And they have nicknames. The most famous guy is this guy named Mokhtar Belmokhtar, Mr. Marlboro. But some of these names are kind of famous. Abu Zaid, we can go into it. But these guys basically swore fealty to Al-Qaeda in 2007. Their first kind of plan was to attack Mauritania because it's a soft target. And the softest target of all was the Mauritanian mines, which are in Zourat, which are the country's only major export income, which were in the town where I was living. So that was kind of wild. They did do that. They cut the train line. There's one train line that gets to the mines. They cut that train line at some point, I forget when. They killed 12 soldiers right by the town. It was kind of scary. Fast forward, and France yet again. And again, Chris, I want to ask you about this, but there's a backstory to like why Gaddafi fell, which is that like Gaddafi's family like possibly illegally funded Nicolas Sarkozy's presidential campaign. I'm not making that. They're very, very powerful people have repeated that in public many times. And lo and behold, the Arab Spring comes along, and then there's protests against Gaddafi. And Sarkozy is like, we got to get rid of this guy, right, NATO? We got to really get rid of this dude. This dude's a lot of trouble, isn't he? And they come up with this bullshit thing about how they're going to, excuse me, I'm sorry, we're not supposed to curse on this.
Oh, it's
They come
fine.
up with this thing where
Oh, we aren't?
supposedly Gaddafi is going to retake Benghazi and where the rebels are
Murder
going. There's
everyone.
going to be a slaughter. He's going to kill everyone. We have to stop him because he'll kill them all, which is in
They
retrospect
invented the whole
amazing.
story about that, where Gaddafi was handing out Viagra to his army to commit mass rapes once they retook Benghazi. The entire thing sourced to one random rumor-mongering person who. And that's it. And all the Western media just ran with it like it was true for the remainder of the war. So
It's
continue.
interesting you say that. It's interesting you say that because they say that about the Russians in Ukraine too. And honestly, I believed it, but I don't know.
I don't know either in that case, but
But
I do know the Libya
now
case
I don't
was
know whether,
there.
yeah, right, whether it's like a
Maybe,
rumor
maybe
mill.
this is just like a meme that they
Well, and
put
this
out
is
all the
actually
time.
like part of the reason I wanted to have you both on is like, to me, trying to make sense of this whole world is so, there's so much misinformation, especially nowadays. So it's helpful to like, just kind of talk about a lot of these details, like what you know for sure is true, and then James, like what you heard on the ground versus what do you think is a rumor, what is reality? Like just parsing this stuff is really fun. I wonder if Chris, if you have any other background or history that you feel like is important from your,
Wait,
research.
actually, I know I've been talking a lot. I'm just trying to set the background so you can
No,
like have these
keep going.
conversations.
Yeah, and then I'll
But
toss
let me
it.
actually just answer Chris's
Oh
question, because
yeah.
that will take us to a point where we're
Okay.
like ready to go, I
Yeah,
think.
go. Go for it.
And now I almost sort of forget it. But the point is that when Gaddafi fell, Gaddafi had been training for years another group of herding, somewhat transient, Berber speaking or Berber dialect speaking people called the Tuareg, amongst many others. Gaddafi, his hands were in everything. And so if you look in the wars in Sudan, if you look in the wars in Chad, if you look in the wars anywhere north of the equator where there's
Northern Ireland,
some
even.
north, indeed Northern Ireland, I have an IRA tattoo actually, and because of my background in that, I know a weird number of like 1980s IRA ballads that are like about how cool Libya
Oh,
is.
I love the IRA rebel music. It is fantastic. It's like really jumping tunes, I gotta say.
There's one called the Sam Song. It doesn't specifically mention Gaddafi, but it goes Chuck Yar La, which is an Irish phrase for our day will come. Sing Up the Ra, the IRA, Sam Missiles in the Sky, and it's sung to the tune of Ghost Riders in the Sky. Very famous IRA song. So Gaddafi falls, and all of a sudden, like SA-7s are in the hands of Torrents, which has never happened. This is
Yep.
stuff starts going crazy, and I don't know the numbers, but millions of guns are just unleashed, and the Tuaregs are like, "All right." And this is an example that we'll talk about more with the PO, who are a bigger group and probably more significant in all this stuff now. But the Tuareg, being a nomadic group, being of a different skin color and background than the people in the central government, have basically spent a long time doing this complicated negotiation for resources. In their case, literal financial resources, not material resources, with the central government, in especially in Bamako, in the Mali, which is the big keystone country in the Western Sahel. And the Malian government is basically like, unless you guys rebel, you don't get a lot of resources because we're corrupt and France is going to back us no matter what happens anyway. And they're a democracy for much of this time, but they're kind of a corrupt oligarchical system that looks like a democracy. These are not real democracies. And the Tuareg's way of getting stuff from them is normally to rebel. And in 2011, they said, "We're going to rebel unless you do X and X and X." And I don't know precisely what those were. And the then Malian president, what's his middle name? His initials are ATT. He was like, "I'm not going to do it." And so the jihadist groups who have used the Tuareg as kind of transit guys, people who know the desert, and as clients, essentially, they have a ton of money for their smuggling. Al-Qaeda and the Tuaregs team up, and they're briefly an unstoppable force, and they sweep towards Bamako, nearly take it, are only driven back with the help of the French. But they and but I guess I'll stop here. But this is the start of a war that looked like it was won as soon as French warplanes started bombing caravans, and actually, like, progressively, first France lost it, and now honestly Russia may lose it. And it just this is a tough team to beat, and they're not a team anymore, but it's weird, and you have to face the realities of people who want to be free and are free and are hard to control.
That's good. I'm gonna toss it to Chris now, and just like anything else that you feel like, from your own background and research that is like important historically to kind of lay the groundwork for this conversation that James hasn't yet touched on.
Well, this is not region-wise a region specialty for myself. West Africa and the Sahel is definitely not something I can claim any expertise in. I actually know way more about its pre-modern history than I do its present-day circumstance.
But
Once
still,
again,
like, I mean, I think
nomadic
in
people stuff.
yeah, and but the important upshot, I think I want to like really bring it out, talk about the details, but then like, what are the upshots? Like, historically, how have these conflicts played out, and what is the upshot for like now at this point in history
Right.
going forward? But yes, so.
Well, I would actually mostly want to pose this as questions to James, but I mean, my first reaction is that seeing all these large exterior empires and PMCs fail in the region is fascinating. My personal memory of when I found out that there were U.S. troops in Burkina Faso was when a bunch some of them died in an operation in here. And this was happening when I was at the State Department. I had no idea we had troops in Burkina Faso. That's how I found out. And that's like part of the after effects of this nonsense. But the fact is, people that are adapted to a certain environment have what we call in the IR world escalation dominance. Geographic proximity alone means that you are always willing to do more near your homeland. It's not just a question of survivability and adaptability. I mean, you can see a fictionalized version of this in the new Dune movies, although I recommend the book even more. But like, this is something that it's not just like an adaptation to nature, though that's part of it. It is literally a spatial thing. These faraway people are only there to make money and protect people making money, and to try to, or in the case of Wagner, in many cases, I think trying to mess with the Western allies in a front that's not Ukraine. But they're none of them have staying power is the thing. It's kind of like how the US didn't have staying power in Iraq and Iran did because it was right there, or how France had no staying power in Mexico, but the US did. My great-great-grandfather smuggled Benito Juarez weapons to drive the French out. So there is always this geographic element of that these kind of big foreign mercenary companies and or alliance networks don't understand. And so I would just like to kick that question to James and also add a new question. So the first question I would ask would be, in the end, the Tuareg are probably going to outlast these people. I imagine, or would you imagine that when they do, that they will break most of their ties with like kind of internationalist religious organizations? And the other question I would have would be, what do you think it will be the reaction to people that enter this long line of cycles of coming in and then probably either leaving or having to double down to stay?
When you say people, you mean
Yes, foreign
foreign powers.
organizations, yes.
So, yeah. So, the Tuareg. I mean, the Tuareg are kind of to wrap those into a single theme, sort of, but answer them separately. The Tuareg are the team with the most staying power, right? Like, I mean, the Berbers were in Africa before the Arabs, and we can go back way, like, but Mauritanians speak Arabic, and they're, I would say, probably mostly Berber blood, like kind of a mix of Arab, Berber, and Black African blood, depending on what caste you're from in Mauritania, and that's the culture I know best. But like, if you go into the mountains of the High Atlas in Morocco, if you go to how do you say it in English? Kabylia in Algeria, Kabylia. If you go to the central Sahara where the Tuaregs live, these are people who kept speaking Berber. These are people who were like, no, we're not even going to get colonized by the Arabs. Forget the French, you know? And there's a thing that at a certain point that becomes its own inertia, I would argue, with regard to the Tuareg. Like you've kept it going this long, like you might as well, you're gonna, it becomes your raison d'être to keep it going. So that goes in, I'm saying that because there's the force of will that is involved with Tuareg culture and Tuareg modes of warfare and Tuareg ways of life. Like is just a re it produces a really, really intense thing that if you guys are familiar, and everyone should read it, it's really good, with the book The Mukaddimah, which is this sort of
It's literally my
important.
favorite book.
There you go. Okay,
Oh.
so you're probably more familiar with it than me, but you know, in the
I cite it
translation that
all
I
the
read,
time.
there's a it, for people who don't know, it's a 14th century, I guess you could call it a study of history, study of empire, written by this.
Historiography.
Yeah, exactly. Historiography is the word for study of history. I should have
I
used
mean,
that.
he's
That's right.
basically,
Yeah.
Ibn Khaldun is considered to be the inventor of historiography by many
Right.
people because
Okay.
of the So.
That's the word I was looking for. And in it, he describes this kind of cycling process of people in the periphery developing what he describes. The translation I have, he uses the word group feeling, which is not super evocative, but you guys
Also
get
be
me.
yeah.
Yeah, group feeling. It's the thing that gives you your culture, force of will, and that kind of stuff.
Solidarity
And
is how we
yeah,
translate it in
right.
English, yeah.
And the Tuareg have, amongst the various tribes, because this gets a little weird, the Tuareg are capable of summoning great amounts of group feeling, in ways that we do not currently in this country have any, I would argue, almost like any cultural memory of even anymore. Like, in answer to the second thing, which has to do with it, I do think that the Tuareg project of building this country called Azawad, where people would speak Amazigh and Berber languages and live freely in the desert, candidly, I don't think that'll ever be achieved, just because like building a nation state on the Tuareg model would kind of, it would involve cutting off northern Mali, parts of Niger, southern Algeria, and it almost feels dated to me. It almost feels like we don't live in a world where you have to do that anymore, or where that kind of state building would be that relevant. The thing that they played with, and they played with fire, and they were, and I say they, I mean essentially one very charismatic leader of one very influential tribe around Kedal did this. This was not the Tuareg got together and did this. But one guy who led them into the alliance with the jihadists played with fire, and they really got burned. They took a lot of heat when that counterinsurgency came in, and it was not good for them. And they didn't want to take Bamako in the first place. The Tuaregs have no interest in Bamako. They have no interest in anything down there. And it made them look bad. They, at one point, you had guys proclaiming independence, which is a terrible look. It sent to the international community this idea that we cannot be worked with. We are crazies. And they now, if you talk to Tuareg leaders in the MNLA, all these different, they have a million groups, CMA, I can't even keep track of them. You talk to leaders in those, they are very practical. They are not, we are sticking, there was a 2015 peace agreement between Bamako and brokered by Algeria between Bamako and the Tuareg. And you talk to young guys who 10 years ago might have been hotheads, they're like, okay, let the Malians rip up the agreement. We're sticking to it. We want this. What happened was, to some degree, that they were so good at appeasing the French and saying, look, we are reason. We are not the problem. The jihadists are the problem, that the French believed them. And a lot of Malians got really mad about this because the French really stopped prosecuting the war against the Tuaregs. And they gave them their mythical sort of, people always call it their redoubt in the north of Mali, this city of Kidal. And they kind of left them after the agreement. There was a peace agreement. The Tuaregs aren't the problem. Leave, they can have Kidal to do their thing. They're good. We're gonna fight the jihadists, who increasingly became Po, young, disaffected herding guys who were having conflicts over grazing land with their neighbors and were driven into the arms of the jihad by persecution from the Malian army, frequently by outright extortion from the jihadists, who would just come to a village and say, we're either going to kill you or all the young men join us. And the young men are like, cool. From Pol preachers who are very much in the tradition of Dan Fodio, who are like, this is what we do. And so the Malian government's war became one of really kind of like brutal suppression of the Po. And it became one where they couldn't really get to the Tuaregs. And eventually, Wagner Group, which has pioneered this model of backing states in counterinsurgencies in the Central African Republic, where yet again, the war is against a largely Po rebel group. The Wagner Group comes in, I don't know, let's say they started, this stuff started in 2021, I would say. The Wagner Group comes in and it takes them a while, but eventually they figure out how to do the desert warfare stuff. And they started just by massacring Po. They'd go to villages, round up everyone, kill all the men over 14, bring helicopter gunships in, just strafe everything, kill people. And then they figured out the drone warfare thing against the Tuareg, and swept north and basically retook everything. They retook Kidal. They hung the Wagner death head over the fort there. They made it clear it was them. And for a while, it looked like, okay, that's it. The Tuareg left. They didn't fire a shot. They gave them the city. They fled. Like 70% of the city's population fled overnight. Like they just went into the desert, disappeared. And I spent a lot of time talking to military officers while I was there this last time. And I was like, wow, that sucks. Like after all this time, like they kind of lost that war like in a week. And they were all like, yeah, just wait. Just wait. Because the staying power of Russians in Mali, to them, and I think this is right, George Bush's former head of Africa counterintelligence, or counterterrorism, sorry, told me the same thing. He was like, the Russians are there because the gold mines that have been discovered in this region send a ton of hard currency to the Russian state at a time when the Russian state really, really needs hard currency. they don't care about Mali, and it's not in their traditional strategic realm. And the French, even where it is in their traditional strategic realm, lost their will to fight, lost their group feeling that made it possible for them to fight wars in Africa for 50 years. They lost that. The Russians are going to lose it a lot quicker. And then we'll just go back to square one.
Oh, okay, so I have a couple of clarifying questions. James, I kind of want you to tell the Central African Republic story, your experience, and kind of help us non-geopolitics people understand what Wagner is and like the limits of American empire that you experienced, or, you know, power as empire. And then after we do a little bit more background, I'd be curious, like just going forward, the rest of the conversation, what does all of this mean for like the statehood, the power of nation states, like stateless nomadic people, collapsing empires? Are we going to be talking at some point about multipolarity, like re-regionalization, all that stuff? So I just want to like flag that those are the concepts I'm interested in. But first, let's hear the Central African Republic story, both because it's awesome and like amazing that you experienced. Awesome and scary a little bit. And, you know, I got a text from James some point several months ago in a group chat, like, I'm held in the Central African Republic without a passport. I'm stuck in a hotel room and everyone's like, are you okay? Oh my God. So tell that story, like how it happened, why it happened, and then let's get a little bit of sense of like what Wagner is.
So I think the first thing, because this is going to get to stuff that Chris understands that I don't. But the first thing to understand about what is happening in Africa today, in terms of the French, particularly the former French colonies, where they're turning really rapidly against the West, people think, you know, with the inflections of American imperialism and, you know, the history of the global war on terror, that a lot of this has to do with like, America's a brutal empire and we drone strike people and we're bad and we bomb people, or we come in and we take your resources and we give you a bad deal for it. We extract them and steal them and head off and get rich off the backs of Africa's natural wealth. The actual truth is sort of the opposite. In that, in the Central African Republic, as later in the Sahel, the big objection to the French and American kind of sphere of influence that we exercised was that we never really cared enough about these countries to like really develop them, to like really invest in stuff like infrastructure, roads. Central African Republic has oil. We never like went to try to develop that oil because it's dangerous, far away, not really worth it for us. And so it's not actually that we stole their resources, that we never bothered with their resources. Their resources were far away, hard to get, and it's too poor and difficult to deal with it, right? So the French were there for a long time. And there's basically, as the French stopped running the country got more and more chaotic. More and more rebel groups would just sort of pop up. You fight for a while, you put epaulets on this on your shoulders and you call yourself a rebel group. And then you can fight for a while and then you can extract stuff from the international community. It's a great, they call them military entrepreneurs. And they're people figured out how to do this really well. A lot of these guys were from Chad. They were kind of spin-offs of the whole Gaddafi thing that we were talking about earlier. A lot of these guys from Chad, a lot of these guys are Po. They're not even really Central African in a lot of ways. Come in. So this goes on for years and years and years and years and years. A few changes of government, blah, blah, blah. Finally, after a particularly really brutal period of events in the middle of the last decade, the Russians kind of say, hey, we can do this. We can do this for you guys. We can get around arms embargoes for your government, that because we're on the UN Security Council. I mean, we can do stuff that other people can't do. And they started selling arms. And then this group, the Wagner group, which kind of got going in Eastern Ukraine in 2014, started working in Libya, started working in Syria. Syria is probably their big, big one. I mean, they took major, major, major strategic victories in Syria were kind of at the hands of Wagner. They had fighter planes and stuff. They developed into a serious military force in Syria, I think. And they come in the Central African Republic and they just start experimenting. They're not People in the international relations world often use the term the Wagner playbook. Like there's this like plan, like we're going to do propaganda, we're going to make a deal with the government, and then we're going to whatever. That's not really true. Like everywhere they go, they just kind of like figure it out and figure out where they can insinuate themselves. And so Wagner started training government troops. They started prosecuting war in the back country. They started taking over gold and diamond mines, especially gold mines. They took over in 2020, they took over the country's only, it is the only to this day industrial mine that has ever been developed in the Central African Republic after all this time. Nobody was getting those resources. And Wagner was like, we'll bring guns with our mining guys, and then we can get the resources. That this works out. This is how we're gonna do it for now. And so they kind of get in de facto control of much of the government, in a place where the government is literally like, you know, it's a few
Non-existent
warehouses.
almost.
Yeah, it's warehouses. It's not, trust me, I saw a lot of these buildings eventually, much against my will. They're, it's not what you think a government is. So, and they make like beer, they made a brewery, and like then like they sent goons to bomb the French breweries because they were like, all right, now all the beer is going to be Russian. There's a lot of, they really tried everything. There's no playbook. They were just pushing and seeing what would
Whatever.
fall apart. Yeah.
That's actually, I would say that is their playbook. When you've looked at their operations in other
Fair.
countries, this is
Yes.
actually kind of how it goes.
That's fair. That's a more sophisticated way of looking at it. I'm just saying, like, it's not step by step. It's like,
Right.
let's see what
Yeah.
we can get away with.
Yeah.
And so I get there November 22nd of last year, and did not know that 4 days later, I mean, this stuff was happening anyway, but this is a good way of pegging it. 4 days after my arrival, a huge New York Times story was about to drop about how America was trying to woo the Central African Republic back out of the Russian orbit. And they were sending possibly our own little Wagner, a private military corporation called Bancroft Global, which is, as a matter of interest, run by a guy who describes in his personal company biography that he's a quote, fifth generation descendant of investment bankers. They were sending in guys literally like the week I arrived. And all over Russian Telegram channels, all over like French language, you know, in Africa, especially poorer Africa, people use Facebook mostly. all over Facebook, there's people saying like America's sending a CIA team like to the Central African Republic like in late November. And I fucking
And
show up
you
like
show
buzz
up.
cut, I'm like
Yeah.
buzz cut.
The timing.
Like yeah, and like I had a camo jacket that I actually thought to take off as I was getting off of the plane, but it
James,
was just
good.
like,
You need to look
it was
more
just like,
normie.
yeah, it wasn't a, and I was writing for Granta, it's a literary magazine. So like you try to explain it, and it's not like I'm here for Vanity Fair, I'm here for the New York Times. Like I'm gonna ask
Right.
you, I'm gonna shove a microphone in your face. You know who I am, you know the terms. It's just me being like, hey, you know, like I'm just here to see what's up. It sounds like spy stuff. And so I was gonna get a visa in place because I just didn't have time to get to the embassy and get my visa sorted out. And Americans traditionally can get visas upon arrival there. And that's been a longstanding thing. And so they take my passport and I'm supposed to come back the next day to get the visa to the immigration office. I do that the first day. They say there was a rainstorm, come back the next day. And I come back the next day and they're like, first of all, there's a Chechen dude named Hassan who's just like there in the immigration office. And I was like, there's like huge arms, tattoos everywhere. And I was like, oh, this is a bad look. And then the Wagner dudes in the immigration office, they're upstairs. Like you can kind of like see them. And they all wear their little like short brim baseball caps and like skull masks and stuff. It's exactly the cliche of what you would think the Wagner Russian mercenaries in Africa look like. They're just in tacticals, you know, with the machine gun on the back and land cruisers, and they have skull masks and camo, and they, you know, knock people out of their way as they tread around. And so they don't talk to me at all, but the the African guys shoved me in the back of a Hilux. There's five of us in a three seat back seat, and take me to the head of the country's internal security. This guy, General Denis, and they interrogated me for a long time. They arrested two other Americans, had them down in a holding cell. I didn't know about them.
Were they just tourists?
So this dude was a part of a Facebook group where they go and try to collect a passport stamp from every country.
Okay.
And so there's
Awesome.
if you go to that Facebook group, it's hilarious because like every 3 days there's a new story like how I got
Once.
arrested by Wagner in the Central African Republic. And it's just
Yeah.
like stop doing this. But in fairness to him, he didn't know at the time. So all of this was normal. And so he came, he was trying to do the same visa thing I did. And they didn't even say, like, come back tomorrow. They just put him in a truck and said, all right, come on, you're coming with us. And then they arrested his guide who had a car passport, a French passport, and an American passport. And the State Department sent, I forget his title, but a relatively high up guy at the embassy. Not, they sent a little team of local employees first and then quickly realized, like, oh, this is not that. And then they sent, the State Department has its own law enforcement arm, sort of like a mini State Department FBI or whatever, who research like passport fraud normally. But they sent those dudes, with sidearms, a man named Pedro, who was high up in the embassy. They were on it. There were people, eyes on us at all times, all of a sudden, because they were way more freaked out than I was. I was just like, this is funny. I didn't tell the magazine. I didn't tell the Pulitzer Center. I didn't tell my family. I was just chilling. And then they showed up and were like high alert. And I was like, oh, I might have a problem here. And then they took us down to a cell and I was like, oh, hold on. Then they took our phones. They already had our passports. And then they kept bringing us back up to the general. My French, I hadn't spoken French in 15 years. My French was
Right.
like coming back as I was being interrogated, and it
That's
was like
stressful too. Yeah.
really, really frustrating for everyone involved. And they
Yeah.
kept getting like really, really annoyed. And long story short, we were released to the State Department with orders to come back and have more interrogations and stuff like that. Me and the other American who had just flown in were staying at the same hotel. So I ended up just sort of confined at this hotel without a phone or passport. In this like kind of really annoying holding pattern where we would be like observed, they would send guys to watch us, but we were like free to move around, and occasionally I did that, and then they would like the local cops knew we didn't have passports, so they would like come and abduct us and be like, you have to pay money because you're not carrying a passport. And I'm like, you didn't even tell me, you don't, I didn't even tell you I didn't have a passport. Like, how did you know?
Yeah.
And they would, it was just, it was like boring and frustrating and annoying. Like it was, I would have preferred almost to be in jail because it would have been an adventure and like there's
Yeah.
no,
As opposed to just being
you'd
in
be
a hotel
learning
and getting
something.
shook down every
Yeah. And
couple
just like
days.
having
Yeah.
your brain stew and like and so eventually I was not technically deported. I was given an ordre de conduite à la frontière, like a I was conducted to the border. But I was like put in the back of a plane. And like the stewardesses had to watch us and make sure we didn't like talk or like touch our phones or stuff until we got to Cameroon, where of course we were detained again because we didn't have visas to get to Cameroon. And then flew to Malabo, Addis Ababa, Paris, 37 hours of flight that I had to pay $2,000 for because we had to leave on a specific day on a specific flight. And that was my Central African Republic story.
And what's your up? Yeah, what's the upshot for you of that experience? Like, just with regard to those larger questions of like American power and, you know.
Well, so I talked to a man named Fidel Guandica, who is the kind of the head of the, his title is really confusing. He's like the head of the Council of Ministers or Minister for the Council of the Presidency or something. But he grew up in the same village as the president of CAR, and he's family members with him, and he's arguably the most powerful person in the country. He came out after Prigozhin's death. He came out and did a press conference wearing a shirt with Prigozhin's face on it that said "Je suis Wagner," also carrying a pistol. He's like a he's a wild guy, and I talked to him because there was this whole little scuttlebutt for a while about whether like there was going to be an American Wagner that was going to kick the Russians out. And Guanjika and the presidency were making these hints that like actually we're going to go back to the Americans. We're considering, they kept saying we're going to cut a deal with the Americans. Like as though a country just can flip-flop based on like how they feel, like into one orbit or another. And weirdly, people bought that when, of course, it's like actually much more difficult. And there's interest groups in the country that are deeply tied to the Russians that would have not let that happen, even if they wanted to, I would say. But he was pretty candid about the game they're playing, which is that in a world where the United States is not capable of just saying to the Russians, you are not allowed to take over this client of ours, they have leverage. And the leverage that they can use is basically, you're allowed to colonize us if you want. He used that word. He said, if the Russians want to colonize us, we accept that colonization. And he said, if they will come and build mines and roads to get to them, if they will come and, now I'm paraphrasing, but essentially effing kill people. Because, and this is a direct quote, we don't want a colonization like the Americans and French, where they, quote, run at the quickest sound of gunfire. His thing was, come in, be brutal, run us, build roads, build mines, give us your wealth. And again, direct quote, if 80% of it benefits you and only 20% of it benefits us, we accept that deal. And that is just a really different conception of empire than I think a lot of, especially liberal and left-leaning Americans have, which is like, oh, we're the baddies. We're the baddies. We're the guys who came in and took all the stuff, and we finance our empire with their, or we run our empire with their resources. That's true. But right now, you are seeing a lot of client states look at the deal we offered and say, actually, we can flip-flop. We can find a better deal. And that deal, in weird cases, often ends up looking a lot like old colonial relationships. And that's not a comfortable fact,
So
that's
there
not a
is
happy fact,
a
but yeah.
very big difference here. There's a very big difference here, and that is that you are dealing with sovereign states making this decision rather than colonies. So a sovereign state can agree to be economically colonized for a net benefit in a way that a colony does not have a choice in the matter. And I think in the end, the ultimate goal of all political entities is some form of territorial sovereignty, even if they sell it out from time to time. And the other thing I can say is that looking specifically at Wagner and Russia, this is once again, I think we've been so conditioned by the rhetoric, whether it's true or not, of the unipolar moment and the American Empire, and the previous Victorian empires before it. We've been so conditioned by this rhetoric of universal values, of universal, that everything is all the same everywhere, that everything is a battle of principles. I could not disagree more. I just think this is objectively false. This is a battle of geography and interests, which are different everywhere and in all different places. And I think it's a very logical decision for these states to look at a place like Wagner and to say, well, we can say, oh, we'll give you the mine, we give you all this stuff. They'll build it. It'll still be there when they leave, of course, and they can take it over. Maybe they have, if they're smart, a provision where you have to train a certain amount of locals to do certain things as you build something up. That would be a smart thing. That's how the Japanese industrialized in the 19th century. But like, what is, and in the end, going to happen is Russia isn't anywhere near Western or Northern Africa. Russia isn't going to do to these places like what it's doing to Ukraine. There's literally zero chance of that. This is actually a not very threatening relationship, even if you sign a very unbalanced deal. You can see the same thing in the inverse. Speaking of countries that have a lot of nomadic people, a country that I've actually spent quite some time in, Mongolia. Mongolia loves South Korean companies. Mongolia loves American financial imperialism. Why is this? It's because it doesn't threaten Mongolian sovereignty one bit, but Russia and China do. If you're a very small country, well, it's not a small country, but population-wise, between the behemoths of Russia and China, you want to do the maximum amount of business with people who aren't Russia and China to give you some international leverage against your more powerful neighbors. I think when you're seeing in kind of post-France Sahel Africa is an ability to leverage against France, because you can bring in Wagner, you can bring in the Americans who certainly aren't going to directly occupy you. These people just don't threaten you in the same way that these countries might be threatened by America if they were in, say, the Western Hemisphere. So, like, I think there's definitely a spatial calculus going on here, and they're thinking, well, we are sovereign states. We can afford to be like, yeah, colonize us, do whatever, give us some kickback. But like in the end, we're going to be here, and you're probably not in a generation or two.
Chris, and like I'd be curious to know too. I mean, you are at the Institute for Peace and Diplomacy. Do you like see this going forward as a route to more peace, more sovereignty? Like, are you aware of these kinds of relationships, and are you advocating for, like, well, how do you think about these things?
Well, I don't think this is a topic that IPD has an official standpoint. I can only speak for myself, and that goes for everything else I'm saying here. But I definitely couldn't make a guarantee as to the more peace thing. I mean, that is going to be entirely down. All politics is local. That's going to be entirely down to region. There's as certain great powers retreat, there will be a power vacuum, and there will be new problems. It's not like a I never conceive of these things as good or bad. I conceive of them as in whose interests and for why, and there's many different interests. But like, so the peace thing, I can't say. But sovereignty, yeah, I think it's going to go on the up, because I think that the thing that people miss when they talk about multipolarity, this is kind of a bugbear of mine. I keep publishing articles on this, but it's true. It's something that people don't grapple with. Multipolarity isn't like the new cold war. It's not the US versus China. It's not the US, China, Russia, or whatever. That's a part of it, yes. But it's really the rise of lots of different countries, including non-great power countries. And as these countries become, because what you have, a proper middle power is regionally anchored. We do at IPD have a great study on the rise of middle powers. It's called Middle Powers in Multipolar World. So if you want to see more on the subject, your viewers can check that out. But like, to summarize, it's like a regionally anchored power that may not be a global or superpower, but in its neighborhood is the most important country, including compared to the superpowers. So if most of your traffic goes through the Black Sea, goes through the Straits of Marmara, and you're really close to Turkey, Turkey matters more than Russia. Turkey matters more than China. And so I think what you are going to see is you're going to see these like multiple power clusters that are going to handle things a bit more in a localized way, just because they're, some of them anyway, are stronger. They're a bit more developed. The world of the 1950s was a world where the United States produced half of all manufactured goods in the world. It was almost half of the global economy. That world is long, long gone. The US is more close to a quarter of the globe's economy, and it also can't produce a lot. I mean, Russia is not producing it when it comes to hard industry right now. The sanctions on Russia have actually backfired so spectacularly, and I predicted this before the war, that it's actually strengthened Russian industry and strengthened Russian power. So it's just like you're going to see, and then with countries that aren't industrialized, bring us back to these kinds of regions, I think what we're going to see is an increase of the amount of options they have. The monopolies are breaking. I mean, the mere fact that Wagner is in the Sahel is already kind of showing something like that. But it could be other things too. We know that Turkish groups, both state and maybe non-state, operate in Libya today. The Turkey has very much put its thumb on the scale in the Libyan civil war. We know that there's a huge defense capability growing in certain countries. India would be a great example, probably a potential future world power. But right now, a very strong middle power. We see how Iran operates through non-state actors for a variety of reasons throughout the Middle East. I just think that, and of course, is becoming a drone pioneer, and like swarm drones that are tested in Ukraine. They're Iranian drones tested in Ukraine. Now they're used in the Middle East back by Iranian operators or allied operators. And I just think that it's going to be more chaotic as people adjust to this as a new balance, of course, but you're definitely seeing more options. And countries that can't build anything, they can afford to shop around. Now, as James rightly said, you can't just drop on the dime. You've got these built-in relationships. Oftentimes corruption smooths the process, right? So it's really hard to get away for someone who's like really in the tank for Russia or really in the tank for the US or whatever. But overall, in the long run, the state as a whole, rather than individual cliques, has the ability ability to kind of play off each other and kind of bargain upwards. And the power balance of the great powers compared to, say, maybe middle powers might be opposed to them is lower. So the while they could conduct operations and kind of covert regime change from time to time, the percentage of these, I think, would go down. So the threat of being forced in a Cold War scenario where either the Soviet Union just topples Hungary's government or the US topples Chile's government, I mean, that will happen, sure, but I don't think it'll happen as much. So proportionally speaking, I kind of suspect it's kind of a more freewheeling world out there for developing countries that have something to trade. And you might see, who knows, this is much more of a reach on my part, but you might see these kind of non-state, maybe sometimes they're nomads, maybe sometimes it's a company. You see these kind of like go-between actors who can keep things off the books, maybe set up some of these networks or counter networks, and it'll be interesting to see how that evolves.
I'm super curious too about that. I was going to ask about that, or maybe James has some thoughts, but like, in this world where there's a lot less monopoly power from a few of world powers, where potentially there's more sovereignty, more bargaining chips, like what happens to these stateless people or nomadic people? Are they able to potentially leverage their ability to be adaptive for more power potentially?
Well, I mean, not to be a Marxist about this, but the
Go ahead,
system
be
of
a
leverage,
Marxist.
yeah, go
with
ahead.
like,
I'm okay with
I mean,
that.
like,
We're
I
all
mean,
Marxists, all right.
I'm
Listen.
not even like I'm not even like up on Marx enough to like really do this well, but like the way that our empire works is leveraging essentially financial control, more so than putting a gun to people's head, and that gets really complicated because to even describe it, you have to talk about the dollar system,
Right.
and like the way that in African countries, just to like an African country just can't spend money the way we can because we have access to a lot of money. We export dollars, we get resources back. They have to hold dollars in order to insulate themselves from currency fluctuations. They can't access international credit market. So like an African country can't just be like, I'm going to build a mine. Because like a mine takes a lot of capital. And if I'm an African country, I just can't go to Chase Bank and be like, I want a business loan to build a mine, because they're going to be like, your credit is bad. And this is a system of control. At a much lower level, the system of control is still to some degree financial. It's can you, a people who does your own different thing that's maybe not the same thing that everybody who runs the state wants you to do or does themselves, can you feed your family with by generating some kind of industry or resource or foodstuff or whatever it is that you need? Can you live your lifestyle through a system that we can't control? And nomads in theory kind of can do this, right? Which is why they have persisted in many ways in maintaining traditional lifestyles that other people have had trouble doing. In the Sahel in particular, this is the only thing I know a lot about. In the Sahel in particular, the drought that began in the 1970s has really made that a lot harder. The gold thing that is a personal interest of mine, just because I was involved in it, is I think particularly interesting because it touches both things. Gold is really easy to mine compared to a lot of stuff. Like I can do it. I can explain on this, but we can do another podcast tomorrow and I can explain to you how to go out and
Gold
mine
mining
gold. Like,
101 for
yeah,
tomorrow.
it's just like not that hard. And at a higher level, it's not that hard. And at a high level, it's easy to launder into international credit markets. You move millions of dollars worth of gold, billions of dollars worth of gold in suitcases on commercial flights. So like all of a sudden you're doing stuff that like we just it's just hard to figure out how to keep in the system. It's hard to keep eyes on it. Like this really throws things off. And I'm not saying that's going to change the world or like change the basic, but what it does is show a path to like how things that let's say in 1999 we thought were on an inevitable track towards globalization, financialization, blah, 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 and unipolarity, blah, blah. it shows a path how, like, actually just a little thing, the discovery of gold, can like start to throw that thing off the rails. And as far as like the kind of regional sovereignty situation in the Sahel, there was, I talked about this on Good Old Boys, and I'm going to talk about it again because it's important. And because after I talked about this, I said in the conversation something about how certain people on Twitter have this meme now about how Black people can't run societies and stuff. And it's kind of pushing back on that. There were a few commenters who were like, "You need to sit down with Curtis Yarvin and learn your stuff
My
because you don't know
God.
what you're talking about."
No,
My
no,
God,
no.
no.
That guy is an absolute midwit. I can't believe what I'm
No,
saying.
no,
Okay,
no. I'll warn you, he is a friend of mine, but but we disagree about
But you
much.
do disagree, yeah.
Why am I saying this? Because, okay, so there was an attempt at what is happening now in this regional bloc that I think probably a lot of people haven't heard of. Because it gets lost in this news about Wagner and Russia and blah, blah, and it's really not just about them. But there's a new regional bloc called the Alliance, I always forget the word in English, Alliance of Sahelian States. It's the AES in French. You'll see that acronym in French more often than in English. And this is a explicitly, their ideology, their state ideology in these places where junior officers have run coups against formerly quote unquote democratic French-backed governments, their ideology is sovereigntist. Sovereigntist and Pan-African. That's their word. And it's this attempt to mass mobilize people to build a, we'll call it Russian-backed. I'll call it like sort of African nationalist, kind of sovereigntist, build from the ground up. We're going to do our own roads. We're going to do our own. We're going to get out of these credit markets that control us. We're going to do our own thing. And this was attempted first in 1984 by this guy, Thomas Sankara, who was the who came to power in Burkina Faso.
I'm a big
And
fan. Yes.
okay. So you, and
Yeah, I
I mean,
remember the
correct
story
me.
from the Good Old Boys. You should repeat it though.
Sankara is like, it's just my, obviously, there's more. I'm going to make it sound rosier than it was, but just bear
Just
with me.
go. That's
Because
fine.
what he did was absolutely incredible. Like, he made the country food self-sufficient, a landlocked, desperately poor country. He made it food self-sufficient in the space of 2 years.
He
He
was the poorest
refused.
country in the world when he first
Yeah.
took power. Yeah.
I actually didn't know that, but that there, and he would do, he made mass mobilizations to build rail lines so that they could mine their own manganese. He planted millions upon millions of trees because he foresaw the desertification that was coming to the region. He himself like rode a bicycle to the presidential office and like played in jazz clubs. Like he was a pretty good like jazz guitarist. But his thing was, like, look, like if we always want to live like them, we're gonna lose every time because we're gonna sell our souls every time for lipstick and champagne. That was one of the things he said. And we're gonna look at an easy way to jump into the ranks of developed countries, and we're gonna play their game, and we're gonna keep doing this forever. So we've got it. He made all of his civil servants wear homemade African garments. He was like, "We're gonna build an a proudly African economy from the ground up, and we're gonna do the stuff that they don't do when they come here to make money and do the mines and stuff like that." And of course, in 1987, he is assassinated by his best friend, and they go back into the IMF and everybody forgets about it.
Likely with French intelligence collusion.
Yes, and sorry, I should have said that. So the French involvement is like weirdly, you would think it would be more firmly established than it actually is, but like for the purposes of this podcast, we can be adults
He
and
was
assume.
popular, so I think they were being subtle. Yeah.
And his the thing that he did that probably sealed his fate was that he did move the country closer to the Soviet orbit. And that was always that was kind of like, all right, your time's up. But that's what happened to Patrice Lumumba as well, and stuff like that. So a lot of times, at least I would argue the Americans, the French less so, but the Americans are kind of like not sophisticated enough to be like, oh, this guy is doing stuff to build his country from the ground up. That threatens our interests. We're just like, oh, he likes the Russians. Okay, that's bad. And
Yeah,
like,
right.
that still happens. That's still what we're doing.
Yeah.
Absolutely. We are doing a
And
soft version of it in Pakistan right now with Imran Khan. So it's still going on.
I don't know that much about Imran Khan, but I do love him. And I would love to hear your thoughts on him too.
I don't want to derail. I'll just say I'm hardly the biggest Imran Khan fan, but it's very obvious that the US put a lot of diplomatic pressure on the coup government in Pakistan when Imran Khan basically said we are not involved in this Ukraine-Russia war. How dare the US try to pressure us? We have a policy. I actually wrote a piece on this for Responsible Statecraft. So if you need more details, but and also
I'll
Ryan
check that out.
great reporting on this. It's basically the U.S. diplomatic machine very much got in bed with the Pakistani coup government because Imran Khan made stance of why would we be involved in a European war? Why would we have to declare any statement whatsoever to declare support for anyone? We're going to trade with Ukraine. We're going to trade with Russia. We're going to do whatever. And that definitely seems to have inspired the U.S. to at least on some level soft facilitate some actions in the Pakistani military, which is why Imran Khan is not in power despite being quite popular.
And so going up that, I think it's important to how to put this. Like when you look at the Russian involvement in Africa, because if you and before I went, I made a list of these. I have like a whole like Google Doc of pieces in major American or major English language outlets about the events in the Sahel. And you cannot find any that do not basically put Russia as the leading actor in terms of like what's going on. And I think that's gonna have to change now to get really into the weeds here because of an election that just took place in Senegal, where a guy who's kind of like on this trip of like the sovereigntist, Pan-African, anti-elite, maybe moving away from the French, but is a young, charismatic, sophisticated man who did not himself win the presidency because he was barred from the presidency for some weird bull, but his proxy guy essentially just won the presidency and trounced for it. And what I'm trying to drive home here is that like the Sonko movement in Senegal is not some kind of like creature of Russian propaganda. And a lot of this anger at the West, and particularly anger at France, that people have described over these years has been always, they've always said that it's this like product of Russian propaganda campaigns. And they make these big reports. Look at what the Russians did. It got this many clicks on Facebook, 30,000 clicks on Facebook. That post changed the election. And I will tell you that I was in Paris and, writing about Africa, so talking to a lot of Africans I just meet, and you'd have like bartenders and waiters and stuff with like Sonko tattoos. They're like cab drivers are like coming up to you like he's gonna win, right? Like they're talking the level of excitement and energy that is coming into this space of politics, into this sovereignty space of politics in Africa is completely genuine and much bigger than any kind of Russian campaign could have ever have manufactured. They glommed onto it. It's a different thing.
There's a surprising credulousness with American media to attribute to Russian competence what really is just people disagreeing with like Washington London consensus as they naturally would, and a lot of these people are bubble dwellers, and they have literally never talked to someone who disagrees with them, and so they're like, well, it must Russians came in and they fed all these lies. I'm like, look, have you ever seen proper Russian propaganda? It's the dumbest shit in the world. Like, no one would believe this. It's they're too like chauvinistic to ever like get a message across to like someone else. It's always just opportunism. They might happen to signal boost a certain thing here or there, but usually these things have a root in a local cause. And if they don't, you'll find out soon enough if it's completely fake. But yeah, it doesn't surprise me at all to hear that.
So I'd be curious, like, oh, James, did you have some follow-up?
No, go for it.
So I'd be curious, okay, so first of all, as people, this very tiny bubble of people who are not on team sports with regard to international politics aren't inside, are like intentionally not inside this bubble that you're, speaking of how the received opinions of what you're supposed to say about international politics, but are also like aware of doomery collapse stuff, but are also materialists in nature, and accept some kind of multipolar future. What's the optimist case to be made? Like, what do we, I mean, we want to see more of this kind of Pan-African sovereigntist type thing flourish. Like, I don't know, maybe we could just paint a picture while being realistic about like material reality, you know, facing the future. You know, maybe just Chris, you could start, but and then maybe James could fill in more detail based on what his experience was. But like, you know, just put it into the universe. What do we want to see more of in this world that we're describing, like the reality of how it actually is on the ground? Yeah, I'd be curious.
I don't know. I think though that the inevitability of the increase in countries that are geographically weighty means that there is going to be more localization. That doesn't mean that everything will be localization. It just means that I think inevitably people are wanting, for security reasons, people are going to want to play up what they can kind of keep at home and then trade things that are less to do with national security. You already see this between the two biggest economies in the world, which is the US and China, with this kind of like a half-assed attempt to decouple the economies. They're not interested in cutting trade with each other. They absolutely want to trade with each other, but they don't, and rightly so, don't want their, especially on the US side, because we're more prone to their cyber warfare and their kind of IP theft. We don't want to have an open door with anything that could be used in national security. Now, as the defense capabilities of certain other countries grow, it wouldn't surprise me if they take a similar tack to all of the great powers. Now, this will have a downstream effect in keeping things a bit more regional. Now, there's a lot of countries out there that don't have a domestic defense base, period. And that, I'm not really including that there. But the fact that it'll be less kind of global logistics supply chain and more kind of regional might create some interesting dynamics, but you're certainly going to see more push for sovereignty, because I think everyone who like isn't like a, I don't know, brain dead Steven Pinker person is pretty sure that like neoliberalism isn't the glorious future that it was promised to be. And I think that there's an understanding that like selling out your local interest to a multinational corporation may not, in fact, always be the first thing that benefits you. So there is a, I think there'll just be more push for sovereignty. And so it's going to take all kinds of. There isn't going to be one thing. Different regions of Africa is going to manifest in different ways, I'm sure. We saw a version of it with Brexit in the developed world, which will, although I would argue it wasn't very successful because Britain is still very much a neoliberal state. But you know, the push, the instinctual push behind all of that is very, very connected to an idea that you can at least sort of hold corrupt politicians accountable if they're local, but there's no way in hell you can hold someone accountable who you don't vote for, who isn't, you know, tied to your community in any way. And so it just wouldn't surprise me if, as you see more people have more nuanced take of economics, maybe taking some parts of neoliberalism that work, but leaving other parts, that you're going to see more of an acceptance of political parties that might start out as opposition parties, that say, you know, we want a more, if we can have it, more, a little bit more autarky in certain parts of our economy, or if they can't, we want the ability to shop around and not be locked into someone's trade bloc. So I would say, proportionally speaking, you might see more of this as just an anti-globalization reaction. I could not, however, tell you how successful it will be, unfortunately. But yeah, that's.
That's the hopeful vision. And I want to quote James back to yourself and have you kind of just expand on this one sentence you wrote in an email to us. How or why the deep disillusionment with the promises of democracy and liberalism has developed so quickly in Francophone Africa in recent years. And I don't know. And then I guess what that means for this region and beyond.
So, okay, yeah. So the disillusionment with France and democracy are deeply linked. And so this is a good way of wrapping up. So I was like weird about this stuff when I was like, I was just writing a memoir about this, because it's going into the next Grounds of Peace. When I was like 14 or 15, I read this book that everyone should go get. I love it. It's called A Quick and Dirty Guide to War. And it's like a picture of the geostrategic landscape of the world in 1983. And it like explains how different, and all of their predictions are completely wrong. But their analyses are really interesting. And it's like all of this stuff that you could then later see, like what France, because they talked in 1983 a little more than when I was a kid about like the spiritual interests of France, and like Gaddafi was the real player at the time. So you could see all this stuff forming, right? Anyway, long story short, I would like look on maps and like draw, like color them in, like as blocks of alliances that I thought could like make a multipolar world that would like break the neoliberal power system. Like this was like the games that I played alone in my room as a
Nerd.
child. And yeah, it was really weird. And one of the fantasies that I had was of the French mini empire, of France as a player in a multipolar world that, as we know, did not happen. France decided in the probably we could say in the Mitterrand era that no, actually we just can't hack it. We're not that guy. We can't do this stuff, and we are a subordinate power. But I didn't know any of that at the time, and I thought of this idea. But you have however many hundreds of millions of French speakers around the world. You have this culture that is at least in its kind of local expression, if not its actual economy, like kind of anti-neoliberal, kind of like interested in localism and its own sort of deep cultural roots and things like this. Stuff that in the Anglo-Saxon neoliberal world, like France has always been a bit of an outlier and stuff like that. I thought this could be like a really cool alternative, and like they'll ally with Brazil and India, and that'll be a different bloc, and then NATO will break apart, and everything will be great. I say that because in the 1990s, when France was subordinating itself to, American interests and the Western alliance, in ways that it had not before, it adopted this thing of like, the glory of France doesn't matter. Our imperial interests no longer matter. We're going to do globalization and democracy. We got to make sure all these countries do globalization, democracy, and liberal economics and stuff like that. And that was actually a terrible thing for the countries that France had, like that France did this to, because they weren't actually equipped for the kind of democracy that France would go and say, okay, Central African Republic, you are a multi-party democracy now. What? Sorry, that's not how this works. You don't even have physical control over your territory. You want to do liberal democracy? Sorry, that's not going to happen. So, and like in Burkina Faso, in Mali, places like that, you had quote in Niger, the guy who just got overthrown, Bazoum. France ended up doing this really, and the United States as well, doing this thing of backing governments that looked in the pages of the Wall Street Journal like they were democracies, but were not at all. Bazoum was outright fraudulently elected. And it is crazy because you will never hear that in all of the stuff of coup government overthrew and the elected president and the US ally, fraudulent election. Leaving that aside, in much the sense that America has a democracy, but not necessarily as many options as a democracy would suggest it has. These countries are not democracies. They're places where an oligarchy gets to pick a guy, and then you go through a pageant of an election and stuff like this. And
We call
people
that a
figured that.
political party primary, but yes.
Exactly. So people figured that out. And these quote-unquote democracies, when they lost, when France lost the force of will that it once had, the group feeling, whatever you want to call it, that said, we're going to go in and these are our boys and they're dictators and they kill people and they throw people in jail, but we hate Gaddafi and we hate the Soviets, so we're going to kill people to make sure they stay in power. When France stopped doing that, these countries started losing control of their territory. So then, what is the point of this oligarchical thieving state? Because it can't even provide security. Right. And so people became very disillusioned. And I keep banging this home, but it was very surprising to me. The thing that people in Burkina Faso and Mali talk about when they blame France, it is not France colonized us. It's France colonized us and then did not protect us. It's a two-step thing. It's not just the one. And I think Given the path, there's no changing the path that France is on, right? We're not like France isn't coming back and becoming the great power that once it might have been. I'm not suggesting that. I'm offering it as an example. The thing that, I guess my optimistic case would be that now that these countries are forced to confront and build a future where they can't pretend that France is the ally that it liked to suggest it was back in the day. And much more importantly, in the long run, as we as a globe develop what might be alternatives to the dollar system, develop as the dollar system weakens, let's put it that way. Some of the kind of like forced, almost like accidental control that like the Western financial system exerts over African countries, like is just going to lessen. Like, and you can already see that in the like Russia not being in what is traditionally conceived of as the dollar system now has already changed the economies of these places because it has to go and get like literal resources that it hauls out in suitcases. That's already like a pullback from the dollar system. But in so much
Resources
as,
found in that country, which is the important part. The material resources often found in that country. Yeah.
and that, like, I guess my big picture, I'm really straining here to come up with an optimistic take, but like, neoliberalism is not just a way of designing an economy. Neoliberalism is a spiritual worldview, or we could maybe say like an anti-spiritual worldview. Like the when we talk about like there is no alternative to this thing that we built, what we are saying is like if you put a value above making money or corporate interest or shareholder value, like that value is not real. Brexit was not the right decision because Brexit meant that Britain would lose money. The GDP would shrink. That it had to be the wrong decision, right? And as that worldview weakens, states are literally more sovereign to make decisions that prioritize their own interests, whether it be environmentally, spiritually, whatever, their interest to build themselves in their own image. Just as a mental conception, they can believe in that stuff in a way that they could not very well in Thomas Sankara's day, right? And that's as far as I can go because I think a lot of, particularly for listeners of this podcast, a lot of what those states will do when they're freed up to do it is going to be horribly detrimental to their environment and may in the long run end up causing absolute catastrophe for their populations because of that. It is possible that you'll have visionaries who are like, our future is deeply tied to this environment. And I can't emphasize enough how true it is that yes, the vast majority of Africans want cell phones and they want stuff that is nice. Like they want consumer goods. Sure, everybody wants consumer goods. That does not mean that they also want to get rid of traditional African ways of life. You are not going to find a large group of any African population that is like, I want to live in a world where I'm not connected to my village elders. That is not going to happen ever. And it's really hard to build that world if you live in a neoliberal mental conception, forget the financial system, just the mental conception, it's hard to build. And that village world is tied to an environment. So you could see a world in which a Thomas Sankara type figure understands that if you want to have the village thing, then you got to have the environment thing. You got to have the ways of life, and the ways of life depend on the environment. And if we're going to build up, we've got to do this in a slow and reasonable way. That could happen. I'm not saying it will, but that would be my optimistic case.
Okay, and this is actually an underlying, you go, Chris, too, but I just want to say one quick thing. This is kind of an underlying, not spoken as often as we should, assumption of the podcast, which is like, optimism arises from the doomer realities. Like there are potential like resource constraint realities that then lead to people being forced to embrace like some more sustainability or more embrace of a local culture or whatever. So I mean, I think that's good. You made a good case. I'll leave it to Chris.
I'm working hard for
You're
it. Yeah,
trying. I
Chris.
know you're such a doom of the all the our guests, you're the most doomer, I feel like, but you also surround yourself with like very stressful cultural situ you're like either in LA or in Northern California or like in Africa and all these places where like his the end of history has ended. Like there's all this stuff going on where you're like, this is so chaotic. But anyways, Chris, you had something to say.
Yeah, no, that what James said, and actually what you just said, really, really builds into like my critique as a person who on contemporary issues is definitely left of center, but whose worldview is what I would call anti-progressive. So not a good fit for that. Like philosophically speaking, it drives me insane, and it's most manifested in the centrist neoliberal worldview, but it's also in a lot of far left thought, and even particularly in America, and a lot of right wing thought as well, especially like libertarian techno-optimism. You see this very weird belief that it's either all the past or all the future, you know, this
Yes.
absolute binary. But this is, and it's a neoliberal myth that, you know, countries develop by just becoming like the West. They assimilate into the everything is capitalism and democracy, whatever. Well, why sovereignty interests me so much, and this could be a less doomer take, although I admit that more sovereignty might mean more environmental devastation. But why it could be kind of like positive is because sovereignty does mean a variety of different outcomes. It doesn't mean a unified outcome because there's many different sovereignties. That means different economic systems, different political systems. And so you will see it almost as a natural selection. You will see some countries suffer as they poison their own environment, and the more farsighted countries will do better and they will pull ahead. And overall, in the more long term, more people will learn from the smarter sovereignist countries with more in it, of a sustainable outlook than the ones with the less sustainable outlook. The other thing I would say, regardless of who you are, this is my biggest problem with neoliberalism. It's not the financialization of everything, though I do in fact oppose that, but it's actually this philosophical worldview that says that countries develop by all becoming the same. And now this is just objectively false, historically speaking. In fact, most countries, the vast majority of countries, have never adopted with supply, developed through supply side economics. The most commonly followed model is actually comes from America. We forget that because we're now the Vatican of neoliberalism. But for most of our history, we followed Hamiltonian economics. And this is actually what Japan copied twice when it had to build two different times. Taiwan did this, South Korea did this, Singapore did this. And a lot of even post-communist and communist in name countries are now moved into a very Hamiltonian-like model. But the thing is, a model of mixed market with a bit of planning, with a bit of state interference, but it's still market-driven. This is never the same in every country. This is always different. It allows for a huge array of differences, something that both free market and central planning governments could not do, which is why it is useful. It's an anti-Platonic economic development strategy, if you will. It is adaptable and whatnot. And so I have an upcoming chapter in a book that I don't know when it will come out. It's a book about tracking kind of like progressivism, like kind of Western NGO progressivism, and how it hasn't really worked in the international world. And I did a whole historical chapter about the development of the Turkish Republic, of early Japan, and I also talk a little bit about the national versus international communist experience. So Thomas Sankara and Vietnam on one side versus like the USSR on the other, and or China, early China versus later China, and it's you know, so this is fresh on my mind, but it's so interesting to me that every country that develops, especially against the odds, especially latecomers or non-Western countries, they all developed in different ways from each other, not on a universal model. And they all, and this is the most important part to the themes that James just mentioned, they all developed not by breaking with the past, but by interpreting the past as a model for a new future.
Oh,
There's a
I
great
love that.
term. There's a great term from this book on the Meiji Restoration that I cited heavily in this thing that I recently wrote. It's Mike Ravina is the author. I cannot, off the top of my head, recall the name of the book. It's about the Meiji Restoration, though. And the term he coins is cosmopolitan chauvinism, which is the idea of wanting to take your place amongst the developed nations of the world by not rejecting, but embracing your local circumstances. So in his case, he was specifically talking about how the early Meiji oligarchs said, this is actually the real Japan. The real Japan is a powerful country that is sovereign and not walked over by European powers. The real Japan rejects like Confucianism Confucianist moralism, which they say, oh, that's a Chinese import, we can reject it, and embraces this kind of pragmatism that was found in kind of late mid to late Tokugawa era philosophers native to Japan in the 17th and 18th century. This process was then he didn't make this case, I made this case, because I was talking about more than one country, more really well replicated in Turkey when the Ottoman Empire fell and Mustafa Kemal threw out the Greeks and the Allies. And kind of reestablished the sovereign power of Turkey. He introduced sweeping reforms, particularly with regards to women's rights, secularization, keeping the economy kind of under control rather than under foreign control, and establishing a non-interventionist foreign policy, which is very different from, the Ottoman Empire. And he sold all of this as being like, we're returning to our true Turkish roots. He didn't say this, we're becoming Thomas Friedman. He sold it as we are like the true Turks. The true Turks weren't these Arab reactionaries who hated women and covered them in veil. The true Turks had women warriors. The true Turks did not feel the need to be part of a quest to Islamicize the world or to unify with all of the Turkic people. They were people who lived in specific areas and they looked out for stewardship for this specific area. And so what you see in this model that comes up, it came up in Burkina Faso later in history, what you see is this supposedly reactionary form, what we now consider to be reactionary nationalism and regionalism, had this extremely progressive element to it when it was successful. It was always like, we got to take care of our environment. We got to have laws that benefit a higher percentage of our citizens. We got to bring more people into the government. And all these government ups had flaws. The Meiji Restoration led to the Japanese Empire. The Turkish Republic did not treat Kurds very well. All these countries have problems. But the point is, of all of this is to show that you can make enormous gains if you wed the kind of instinctual conservatism of like place and particularity with the kind of progressive drive to improve your circumstances. And I wouldn't be surprised if we see more of that in the future as sovereignty becomes a bit more important for developing countries.
Oh my God, that was like Doomra, the whole Doomra Optimism podcast in a nutshell. Like, and especially now I'm like, I just discovered that Paul Kingsnorth wrote a book called Real England. Have either of you read this book? James, did you read it?
No,
Um,
I
it
didn't.
was he wrote a basically like an anti-globalization book where he just like went and met the Zapatistas and all these like anti-globalization activists. And then after that, he went all around England and talked to like farmers, fishermen, like this Englishness, these English institutions. And I was like, I had no idea. And to me, like this is the future, at least of what I'm interested in for a period of time. Like, what is like re-embracing place and particularity mean like at the end of history, and how is that neither like reactionary return totally to the past nor like forget the past entirely and move, towards this techno-optimist transhumanist future, but instead like this melding of the two, this like, we don't have to throw away antibiotics to then like care about Chicago-ness, it's like you can care about your place and like your Southside Irish history and also like have a dentist, these things can go together and women can still vote. Things were, so anyways, I love that. But okay, final thoughts. James, do you have anything you want to say before we wrap up?
No, I mean that. I feel like that like summed it up really well. That was like maybe more optimistic than my take. I guess I was thinking as you said that I have wrestled somewhat traveling Africa recently with a thing that I hear a lot, which is actually like bring back the American Empire, like come back to us. You have left us to the mercy of the Russians and the Chinese, and they're not as nice as you guys were. And it's something that kind of scares me. And I don't think first of all, I don't think that that's a fate that's locked in. I don't think that, like the American Empire pulling back means that now like Chinese robot soldiers are going to go through Nigeria and take all the oil.
And is the American Empire as it used to be even possible anymore? I mean, that's the
That's
other
what
thing.
Chris that's what Chris was saying before, right? Is that it's just the math doesn't work anymore,
Well, and it's
right?
just that
And
everyone is so brainwormed in the State Department and everywhere else. Like, they just
it's
can't even.
dangerous that people think that we could return to it because they are literally arguing for overexpansion. They want to turn a very successful state, even if it's declining, into something that it pe behaves like, I don't know, like Imperial Germany in 1914. Like they want to just like do things that we can't
Yeah.
do, get us into corners we can't escape.
Yeah.
And that's where I was going with this, is that I do wrestle with this, and this isn't going to be, maybe I might be like more pro-American empire than the average listener of this podcast. But just because I've seen the regrets that people have as it pulls back. But
Yeah.
the thing is, the math does not work anymore. And that, like, we as a society, since this is a foreign policy oriented, rare foreign policy oriented DO episode, like, I think we have to figure out a way. Chris, I know you're in the thick of this and you take probably a lot of fire for it, but like, figure out a way to present yourself as a moral actor while also being realist and materialist, and just saying, look, like, I'm not saying that I want to see Russians like wipe Lviv off the map, but there's problems with how we've been doing this, and it just, the math doesn't work, and we can't, some of these are irresolvable for the moment, and some of these are just going to have to play out. And I wrestle with that a lot morally, because you deal with these things of like, oh, you're going to leave Africa to its own devices, like, you're not going to build their wells anymore, you're going to leave Ukraine to be swamped by the Russian forces. And I don't, these aren't things that I luckily have to take a position on, but they are things that like are increasingly beyond our control. And I think for those of us who do work, me less so than you, but who work in the foreign policy world, like, I hope that we can get to a point where this kind of localist and sovereignist thing is not wrapped up in this kind of like weird, oh, you're anti-American, oh, you're pro-Russian, oh, you're blah, blah. That's not what multipolarity is about. That it's just really
No.
not. It's about looking at the world that in a world way that is real and trying to make the best of it.
There are simpletons out there who, because of their opposition to many, and there have been many, many, many in my lifetime in particular, terrible American policies. There are simpletons out there that therefore say that the other countries are good and the US is bad. This is just so alien to how I view the world. But it also goes to show how stilted our discussions are when so many people assume that is how I view the world.
Yeah, that's what they
Yeah,
think you're
right.
saying. Yeah, exactly. Like
And
it's
I'm like, no, I'm not. Like, my whole point is that great powers are great powers. That American exceptionalism doesn't exist in either the positive or the negative sense.
Yeah.
It's just not a thing that exists. But like, it's very hard because it's forced into this weird binary, and everything becomes a referendum on American virtue or domestic politics. And I just totally disagree. There's a whole wide world out there. There's a lot of divergent interests. I am not even going to begin to attempt to put universal value on any of it. We have a phrase in the realist community, which is a blatantly false phrase from a literal standpoint, but is symbolically true, which is there is no such thing as humanity. There are only states and tribes. And if you study international relations, like, yeah, okay, but that statement really isn't true. But th there is a there's something to that, nevertheless. And to me, I just think that I mean, I'm perfectly okay being viewed as an amoral balance sheet calculator, because I have no need to be seen by my critics as virtuous. I don't particularly care, but I do totally see your point, that in general, I think people are that are more skeptical of the systemic processes of like the military industrial complex and overextension. They need to make a case that doesn't just show the balance point. They need to show a constructive and positive vision as to what a restraint does not mean isolationist, itself a BS term, by the way, invented in the Cold War, but it doesn't mean like cutting off all doing anything. It just means like having a realistic, grounded a default more towards diplomacy, and what that constructively would look like. And I mean, I've started just the very beginning of moving in that direction. If any of your viewers are interested in how I think geography plays a key role in conceptualizing North America as a place that is worth looking at, is a key worth developing in its own right, and how we understand alliances, I think people should check out my co-authored with Artem Moeni, my piece on George Washington and his views on foreign policy. That's over at IPD, because we really tried to be like, what is something we could call a realism for America that makes a case, an ethical case, for why we should be less warlike, but also, a very kind of open to our relationships with different kinds of countries, and that doesn't threaten us. It's not a battle of values. And George Washington was the original kind of inventor of this. He was a land surveyor, and he was a general. He understood topography. When he was on vacation, he would make measurements of just random land he was passing by because he loved it so much. And this
Nerd.
totally formed his concept of how foreign policy should be conducted. And then the fallout from our previous extremely close relationship with France immediately deteriorates after the war, and our first unofficial war with the European power is actually a naval conflict with France and the Caribbean. That combined with his understanding of like regionalism, I think is the beginning of a discussion. I'm not saying that we've today's circumstances maybe we all become George Washington, but the beginning of understanding, I think, how localism plays in with a big messy globe. I think we can learn a lot of lessons from the past, and I think a good place to start, and I want other people, yourselves included, and everyone watching this, to help like bring forth this conversation. And I really think George Washington's actually, for Americans anyway, is a great starting point to kind of viewing like, okay, if there is re-regionalization, what's a logical way of doing it? What did it look like in the past? Not just in other countries, but here. Because we weren't always like how we are now. We have very different concept of what the national interest was in the late 18th century. And it's interesting to just to see, oh yeah, of course some of this we threw out. Of course we change. But some of the stuff we got rid of shouldn't have gotten rid of, some of it was good. And so once again, it's that selective mining of the bad. This is cosmopolitan chauvinism, American style, perhaps. But I think that the career of the early republic actually shows a lot of promise in looking into this field. And I hope in the future that we'll have more discussions about what a specific American interest is that is rational, without being too ideological, and also without being too, chauvinistic. Because in the end, who were the first people that we had diplomatic relations with outside of coordinating with France? It was Morocco. And what did George Washington say in his diplomatic correspondence? He said, "We're not here to wage war on all kings, just ours. And we're not here to, convert your religion or your form of government. We just want to trade with you. We pose no danger to you, and you pose no danger to us. All we can share are shared hatred of British naval power together." And this is the kind of pragmatism that I would like to see more.
I love that. And I'll just briefly say, I feel like we need so many more thinkers who think at all about geography and the impact it has on like resources and culture and the way society should develop. I remember reading this book and hearing this talk by this author, Bill Cronin, who I guess was on Peter Allen as a previous guest on Doom or Optimism. He thinks this way a lot. He had this amazing dissertation committee that was like Bill Cronin, this author, the guy who John Foley, who runs this resilience website. Anyways, all these amazing thinkers. And Bill Cronin wrote like a natural history of Chicago, and he came and talked about like Portage, Wisconsin, and it's named that because it's this connection between two rivers where you would have to like carry your boat from one to the other and for movement. And I was like, oh man, I love this. I love like thinking about history in terms of geography. And I was like, wow, I can't wait to read all the authors who do this. And it was like, oh, it's basically only Bill Cronin and like Peter Allen who thinks about this stuff by himself.
There are some, but it's
Wait,
rare.
wait, wait. Yeah, I actually, you probably remember this piece. I wrote very specifically an unheard piece about the work of Bernard DeVoto, who is a historian, a geographer disguised as a historian and one of America's great historians. It has a weird title because it's, I think the head of the piece is called "Capitalism Killed the American West," which is not untrue, not exactly the point of the
Unheard,
piece
yeah.
either.
Else, yeah.
But the point that I was making is actually that there's a the DeVoto trilogy of pre-independence America and then the early Republic describes a country that actually grew essentially through rivers and argues that particularly west of the Mississippi we're a nation of watersheds and like how that works. And the best one is across the Wide Missouri, which is the history of the fur trade. And the picture that he gives, this is, and I will, this will be the last thing I say. The picture that he gives is not one of genocide and conquest. It's one based on extraction. And because of the extractive system that existed in the larger globe at the time, it inevitably led to the end of its own, the end of the fur trade led to the end of itself because it mined out all the beavers and things like this. But during its development, you had interaction between people who lived off the land that was not based on warfare or conquest, that was based actually on mutual respect and mutual interaction in ways that I think actually we are coming back to. And I think it is a very positive story. And it's a big, long, tough book, but I highly recommend it.
Yes, I remember this piece. I basically like I think this is the probably a central question of the next decades, if not century, especially as you go more regional, multipolar. And then I think I love what you said, Chris, about like bringing forth some history from the early Republic of examples of thinking this way. I feel like this that is could be a whole series of podcasts, writing articles. So, those who are listening who are interested in such topics, get in touch with Chris. Chris, you have a Substack, right?
I have a it's actually a WordPress because I've had it since 2015. My personal site is just called GeoTricks there. I think it's the only thing called that, so it should be easy to find.
And we'll put links to how to find Chris. Everybody already knows probably how to find James. This was so wonderful, you guys. I really feel like you're kindred spirits. I'm so glad we were all talking together. This was, I feel like you're two of the most interesting thinkers on these topics. So I really appreciate you both
Oh
taking the
wow,
time.
that's heavy praise. Well, I will also praise you back because I met you in person in Uruguay, and I know for a fact you're not just a Twitter troll and you're not just the doomer optimism host. As great as you are at those things, you are actually a fantastic host to a traveler, and it was a great time. So thank you, Kristen.
Oh yeah, that was fun. Yeah, so this was great. Thank you both. Thanks,
Thank
James,
you.
as always.